Hello everyone, welcome to this week's episode of the Men Podcast. I'm Demi Wright, and if you haven't already, don't forget to check us out on Instagram at mem.cast for our weekly question of the week. This week, I'll be talking to you about chest drains. So I'm one of the respiratory registrars in the East Midlands, and it's one of the procedures that are essential for the INT training, and also it's one of the procedures that are essential for the medical registrars to be able to do. So I'll go through the indications, the contraindications, a few tips, and the procedure itself. So let's start. So everyone knows what a chest drain is. So it's what it sounds like. So it's a tubing that goes into the intrathoracic cavity. And why would we do a chest drain? So there are several indications, but if we want to break it down, pretty much it is going to be therapeutic most of all. Okay, so therapeutic in the sense of, well, are we removing something? So are we removing air? So pneumothorax, are we removing fluid? So a pleural effusion, in particular. Are we removing pus? So empyema, or are we removing blood? So hemothorax, but usually hemothorax is under the remit of the surgeons. Another therapeutic indication is where we put something in. So instillation of medications, particularly talc. So a talc pleuridesis would be another reason that we would do a chest drain. However, usually a chest drain would have happened after we've drained off the fluid and then put the talc in. It's also going to be put in after certain procedures. So if we've done a medical thoracoscopy or a VATS procedure, then a chest drain would be standard after those as well. But for the general medical population, particularly at the IMT level, it's going to be the first two that I mentioned previously. So in terms of the contraindications, we need to know about when is it not safe to do it. So when are we not going to do this procedure? So the most common thing is going to be a coagulation abnormality. So you need to be checking these things. If someone calls you and you need to be inserting a chest drain, you need to say, okay, there's an indication. Is there a reason that I should not be doing this chest drain? So we're looking at the INR. If the INR is greater than 1.4, we need to delay. Unless, well, depending on the indication, if it's something that's urgent, and the reason that INR is greater than 1.4, that might need treating. However, but generally speaking, if it's greater than 1.4, we won't be doing it. If the platelets are less than 100, then I would say delay as well, unless speak to, you know, your senior or a hematologist to see if platelet cover will be required, depending on the indication. Any anticoagulant that the patient is on. So if they're on warfarin, we need to wait till their INR is less than 1.4. A DOAC, we need to wait at least 48 to 72 hours. So it's going to be variable depending on which DOAC and where you work, what the guidance is. Just check your local hospital guidance. If they're on low molecular weight heparin, so enoxaparin typically is used in the hospital trust, and it's usually given in the evening, which would mean usually by the daytime, the following day, it should be okay to be given. You need to wait 12 to 24 hours after it's been given. If they're on unfractionated heparin, then waiting 2 to 4 hours after that. If they're on clopidogrel, then you need to wait at least 7 days, so the half-life of the platelets. If they're on aspirin, low-dose aspirin, then that can be continued, so you don't need to delay because of aspirin. So coagulation abnormalities we just covered. Another reason that you would not jump to do a chest drain would be someone that has a trapped lung. So what do I mean by that? I mean that there is a process in the chest cavity that is preventing the re-expansion of the lung. So usually that could be someone, they could have had a previous pleuridesis, or they could have had a underlying lung malignancy that's led to a fibrinous process that's prevented that lung from re-expanding, and it's stuck in the position that it is. So what that means is that if you put a drain into that fluid or air that's there, it will not make any difference to the expansion of the lung. Of course, that would just need to be discussed with the respiratory team. Okay, so let's move on to complications and consent. So Whenever I'm consenting a patient, I always mention the following things. So that they will get some pain. However, we use local anesthetic, so they'll feel the initial sticks of it and it shouldn't be too painful after that. They might feel a bit of tugging, a bit of pressure, but it shouldn't be too painful after that. There might be a bit of bleeding, but we need to check the platelets and the medication to make sure the chance of that are reduced. There's a chance of infection with all medical procedures, but we do everything under sterile conditions to try and prevent that from happening. There's a risk that the procedure might not work and we might need to try again. There's a damage to internal organs, so any surrounding structures like the diaphragm, the intercostal vessels, the underlying lung, we just need to tell them about. There's a risk of pneumothorax if we do damage the lung, and if that does happen, the drain will be the treatment for that as well. And of course, we need to also mention that there is a risk of death. So a very, very, very small risk due to vagal hyperstimulation, but we do need to mention that as well. So in terms of safety that I mentioned before, we need to make sure that there is a proper indication for why we're doing this chest drain, okay? We need to make sure that there is no contraindication to doing it. We need to be doing this ideally in hours where there's adequate support, because the studies have shown that there's increased morbidity, increased complications when it's done out of hours. So we shouldn't really be doing chest drains out of hours unless it's clinically indicated. So unless it's someone that's really unwell that will benefit from a chest drain out of hours, then we'll do it. But otherwise, we should really wait till in hours. We need to make sure that we review the imaging. So make sure that we are doing the procedure on the right side. So not the side on the right, but the correct side. And also make sure that we have appropriate consent. So when we're going on to do the procedure now, we need to gather all of our equipment. So I would say number one thing that's going to be helpful is going to be an ultrasound machine. So if you're not ultrasound trained, then you need to get someone that can assist you with this. Get a chest drain kit, which should have everything that you need in it besides the chest drain. Some cleaning materials, so that's the ChloraPrep and the local anesthetic. Okay, so when we're going to talk about the chest drain, does size matter? Does the size of the chest drain matter? And I would say yes, the size of the drain matters. So the smaller the chest drain is gonna be the more comfortable for the patient, but you also have to be considering what are you draining. So if you're draining something like an empyema, then you're gonna need a larger bore chest drain, because the turbidity, the viscosity of that fluid is gonna mean that the fluid is going to be more likely to make the drain get blocked, and then that's going to just lead to more complications and a prolonged treatment phase for that patient. So a larger bore chest drain if we're draining fluid, particularly empyema. So you can really go up to, for empyema, the minimum I would do for empyema is an 18 French, but you could do 20, 22, 24 French, depending on what you're dealing with and depending on what you're comfortable with. Keeping in mind that a higher bore chest drain is going to be more painful, more uncomfortable for the patient. So a smaller bore chest drain for a pneumothorax is entirely reasonable, or a simple pleural effusion, then you could consider that. The lidocaine that I mentioned, so you really only need 1% lidocaine, and you need about 10 to 20 mils. So you're gonna be calculating that depending on the patient's weight to know the maximum dose that should be given. So that's 3 milligrams per kilogram is gonna be your maximum. You really don't need 2%, you really don't need anything higher than 1%. So we just need to be conscious of the lidocaine, because I do find in my practice that they don't understand lidocaine that much, and they feel like they need the higher percentage to have adequate local coverage, but actually you really, 1% is more than enough, and higher percentage is going to increase that risk of toxicity. You also need to get your underwater seal with the sterile water, and you need to prepare that beforehand. You need to get the chest drain tubing, and you also need to get two sutures, so some 1-0 silk is going to be ideal. And you need a pair of scissors or scalpel, and you need the chest drain dressings. So when we're doing the procedure, ideally this should be done in a procedure room. If one is not available, then it can be done at the patient's bedside. We just need to bring everything with a cleaned trolley and get an assistant, ideally, so that I can do the procedure more comfortably. In terms of positioning the patient, it can be sat up. So sat up on the bed, and if you bring their side table so that they can rest their arms on it for support, and having that assistant in front of the side table, because of course those are on wheels, you don't want them to fall. If they're not able to sit up, then they can be propped up in bed, but you also need to have the arm raised up behind the head for proper access. When we're going to look at the positioning for the chest drain, a good place to start is by identifying the safety triangle. So the safety triangle, what do I mean by that? It's bounded anterior medially by the lateral board of the pectoralis major, inferiorly by the horizontal line at the level of the nipples, which is in males, of course, or the fifth intercostal line in females, and posteriorly by the anterior board of the latissimus dorsi. Why is it called the safety triangle? Because it's thought that this area is safe, quotations, because it avoids any major damage to chest wall, muscles, and the breast. I would say that this is the area that's gonna be least likely to cause any significant damage. So if you have the indication such as a pneumothorax, then this is gonna be the landmarks that you'll use. Otherwise, you're really going to be using the ultrasound for guidance, because even though it is, yes, the safe, relatively safe area, you can still cause damage, and ultrasound guidance is gonna be the standard that we should be using. So we found where we're going to be going. So using the ultrasound, if it's any sort of fluid, if it's a pneumothorax, we're gonna be using the safety triangle. We would have had all of our equipment already prepared. I would have asked my assistant or a nurse to give a stat of Oramore for 5 to 10 milligrams before the procedure, just to help with being on ease of the procedure. I'm gonna clean with the ChloraPrep, and everything's going to be done under sterile conditions. Make sure that the area is draped appropriately. And then we're going to be doing the Seldinger techniques. Generally, you do your local anesthetic. And then when you're doing your local anesthetic, you need to do a bleb in the skin, and then with the orange needle, and then you're going to use the green needle to anesthetize the pleura. So there's no need or indication to anesthetize any of the subcutaneous tissue beneath the skin and until you reach the pleura, because there's no pain receptors there. So what needs to be anesthetized is the skin and the pleura. So after you've anesthetized the skin and the pleura, then you'll use your scalpel to create a nick in the skin, and that's going to be about the size for the drain. You insert your needle, get some fluid or air, and take off the syringe, insert your guide wire, remove your needle, the dilators, and then insert your drain whilst always holding on to the guide wire, and then removing the guide wire once the chest drain is inserted. You're gonna be using a three-way tap for the chest drain, and that's gonna be making it easy to make any changes or adjustments to the chest drain. And then it always needs to be attached to an underwater seal, and it needs to be secured tightly with sutures. So one of the common things that we see, that we always see, is that chest drains are being secured with just dressings. So chest drain packs do come with a chest drain dressing, but all chest drains need to be sutured in place. And ideally you can put two sutures in and make sure that it is taut around the chest drain, so that the chest drain does not become displaced. Okay, so do at least two sutures, and then you apply the chest drain dressing. There's also a HypoFix dressing that we can use to create a mesentery onto the drain, so that there's not undue pressure when the patient moves that will cause it to dislodge. After the chest drain's inserted, we need to advise the patient not to raise the chest drain bottle above the level of the heart, because of course, by means of the way the chest drain works, the whatever's been in that tubing or in the actual bottom of the chest drain will then go into the chest cavity, which of course we don't want. And then if we're draining fluid, then we need to clamp. So when I say clamp, I mean turn off the chest drain after 1.5 liters is drained, and we need to keep it closed for, you know, 1 to 2 hours after, to reduce the risk of re-expansion pulmonary edema. And then after that, we can put it onto free drainage. All chest drains at the insertion need a chest x-ray after insertion. So always get a chest x-ray, and what we're looking for is appropriate positioning so that it's in a safe position and that there isn't any significant complications. And after we've connected the chest drain to the bottle, then what do we need to check for? How do we know that we're in the right position? So we need to know, is the chest drain swinging? So swinging means that the column of fluid in the underwater seal is moving up and down with respiration. So that means it's in the intrathoracic cavity, and the negative intrathoracic pressure is causing those movements with respiration. So then we know it's in the right area. And we also need to know, is it bubbling? So bubbling is one of those signs that we will be particularly keen to see if we're draining a pneumothorax. So bubbling means that there is escape of air from that intrathoracic cavity. So if there's a pneumothorax, you'd expect there to be bubbling. If there's no pneumothorax and it's just fluid, you might not see bubbling. You might see bubbling if you've had entrainment of air through the actual insertion of the chest drain, but generally speaking, if you don't see bubbling on insertion for a pleural effusion, don't be alarmed. That's normal. We wouldn't necessarily expect to see it. But if you have a pneumothorax, we would be expecting to see bubbling. If the indication is a pleural fluid, then we also need to be prescribing flushes. So 20 mils of normal saline 4 times a day. And that's just to prevent the blockage of the chest drain. And lastly, to finish up, if we've inserted a chest drain, some of the samples that we'd need to send off, if it's not a pneumothorax, would be sending the fluid for culture, TB, AFB, protein and LDH, where we can do the light criteria, and then of course cytology if we're considering something like a malignancy or malignant pleural effusion. Okay, well, I hope that was helpful. And don't forget to check us out on Instagram at mem.cast for our weekly question of the week. And please do get in touch if you have any special requests. We'll see you next time.